Podcasting from the Garden State, welcome to another edition of the New Jersey Legal Update, presented by Stark & Stark, a 100-attorney law firm with offices in Princeton, Cherry Hill, Philadelphia, and New York. The New Jersey Legal Update is a weekly podcast providing the latest information on legal developments impacting those living or doing business in New Jersey.
Hi, my name is Paul Norris. I'm an attorney of Stark & Stark in the litigation department. Today I'm going to be talking about a topic that I did talk about somewhat in the past. This has to do with what is a subcontractor. Previously I talked about this with regard to a claim under the Miller Act, which is a federal act during which a claim can be brought against a bond on a construction project. Today I'm going to be talking about how this federal law may actually affect state law. And the reason I would like to talk about this topic, it's an area of the law that has not yet really been explored in the state courts in New Jersey. However, it is one that could one day form quite a surprise for whether it is a general contractor or a subcontractor, should they not heed this advice. The question, a simple question, is what is a subcontractor? And although this may seem like a simple question, what guidance does the court or a contractor or developer have in determining whether a party can be classified as a subcontractor? There are, of course, the simple cases where a subcontractor is somebody who comes on site and does installation and provides materials while doing the installation. There's also a simple way to define a material supplier, somebody who's provided, let's say, sand, somebody who's provided concrete. The question becomes, is there a time when a material supplier can be viewed as a subcontractor? And you may ask why this is important. The reason it is important is under the lien law, which exists in the state of New Jersey, a subcontractor may file a lien on a project, and a sub-subcontractor may file a lien on a project, as well as a supplier to a subcontractor may file a lien on a project. Now, going over to the material aspect of it, a material supplier may file a lien on a project. However, a supplier to a material supplier is out of lien rights and cannot file a lien on the project. Now, the question becomes, what if in some instance an individual, a company that the contractor or general contractor only viewed as a material supplier is later determined to be a subcontractor? What happens is now you have potentially an anticipated lien claim from any party that worked below this material supplier who's been viewed as a subcontractor, such as a supplier to the material supplier could file a lien on the project, and also a subcontractor to the person who was first viewed as a material supplier can file a lien on the project. Now, if this was obviously a municipal project, instead of a lien on the project, you're talking about a claim against a bond. And this determination becomes important because it may lead the general contractor developer to liability should this first-tier party fail to pay a second-tier party. For instance, if this purported material supplier, which is later viewed as a subcontractor, fails to pay the parties below it, then the general contractor or developer can be held liable. It's all a little confusing, but in essence, what we're concerned with is whether a material supplier could be viewed as a subcontractor by the court, and therefore extending the potential liability of both the general contractor or indoor developer. Now, the determination as to whether a material supplier may be viewed as a subcontractor is one that's often very technical. Some of the things the court may look at would be the format of the contractual documents which established relationship between the material supplier and the contractor, what the party's understanding was in entering into the relationship, whether the material supplier was required to obtain a performance or payment bond, whether the supplier was subject to the terms and conditions of the general contract, whether retainage was held by the general contractor from the supplier. This is a factor that's very indicative of a subcontractor relationship. Whether the supplier received progress payments or was simply paid for materials that were delivered. Once again, progress payments are indicative of a subcontractor relationship but not a supplier relationship. whether the supplier maintained a significant inventory of the type of material which the general contractor ordered. Once again, if there is no large material maintained by the supplier, it's indicative of a subcontract relationship. Whether the supplier performed on-site labor. Obviously, on-site labor is what most people view as a subcontractor. So if that took place, if somebody is classified as a supplier, the court may weigh that in favor of finding the subcontractor. Another factor is whether the supplier undertook any duties which are not customarily expected of it in the industry. For instance, if a supplier is just supply sand and that's all they did, it's very indicative of a supplier relationship. However, if the supplier supplied sand and did other things with it on the project site, that is something that's not customarily expected. It may weigh towards more a finding of a subcontractor. Another issue is whether the supplier played any role in the design of the structure. Another issue is the percentage of the cost to which the supplier participated in the project. Another issue is whether the supplier submitted change orders. And then the final kind of catch-all phrase is the substantiality and the overall importance of the supplier's role in the project. All of these factors, which are cited above, are very important in making a determination whether a material supplier is in fact a subcontractor. It is a factually sensitive issue. And a word of advice for general contractors and developers is if in reviewing these issues, it appears that the person they have hired as a supplier to do work on the project may be considered a subcontractor, it's often in their interest to take a little bit of extra steps to make sure that they're protected from any potential lien claims and or any potential claims against a bond should there be issues with payment of this supplier to any sub-tier suppliers or sub-tier subcontractors. One of the way they can do that is to require that the person post a bond, and that would be more specifically done on municipal projects. That way they're covered. Another issue would be if it's just a general commercial project is to have very carefully executed lien releases by this material supplier. Also to have a provision requiring full disclosure of any sub-tier suppliers that this person may use. And these are the kind of things that they can do, that a developer or a general contractor can do, that can protect itself from lien claims being brought against it, indoor claims against its bond. And this becomes very important because if we're a general contractor or developer to pay a large sum of money to this individual, to this company, and they fail to pay their sub-tier suppliers, they could be left with a situation with a very large lien claim brought against the project and or against a bond. And now it's put them in a position where they have a very difficult situation to deal with the owner because it was not anticipated. So word of wise to all the developers and suppliers, consider these factors that we discussed above. And if there's any doubt, take the precautions as mentioned. As I said before, this area of the law is somewhat new in even the federal courts. And I have a matter pending before the federal courts, which I prevailed on, which is now before the Third Circuit. It is an area of law that really has very little discussion in the state courts. And what this means is that all it takes is a clever attorney or a clever party to all of a sudden assert that the person above them who didn't pay them was in fact a subcontractor, and therefore they're entitled to bring a lien claim, and therefore they're entitled to make a claim on the bond. And this type of situation, like I said, could very much expose the general contractor or the developer to extended liability that they were not anticipating. So once again, I thank you for your time. My name is Paul Norris. I'm an attorney with Stark & Stark. I work in the litigation department. You can contact me via email at pnorris@stark-stark.com or contact me at area code 609-895-7332. And I thank you for your time.
Thank you for tuning in to this week's installment of the New Jersey Legal Update by Stark & Stark. And be sure to join us each and every Friday for another insightful discussion. We'd like to hear from you. If you have questions, comments, or would like more information about Stark & Stark and the services we provide, email us at podcast@stark-stark.com.